It's 9 o'clock, so I think we'll begin the forum. Tonight's forum is entitled Gaddafi, Israel, and Us, Some Things We Need to Know. Just before I came over here tonight, I looked at the Wenatchee World, and the lead article was a report of a basic story in the Wall Street Journal where Colonel Gaddafi is being suspected of some planned terrorist activities, and at the same time the United States is reported to have some planned airstrikes against Libya in the near future. Leading us in our discussion tonight is Dr. Herman Reuther, who hails from the University of Illinois, where he has been professor of political science and political economy. And those of you who have been involved in some of his sessions know his expertise on the Middle East. So Dr. Reuther will be our presenter and facilitator for our discussion.
Thank you. Good evening. I don't want to start off contradicting you, but my institutional affiliation is not with the University of Illinois. I have association with different schools in the Chicago area, and I professionally have been a political scientist, though currently I've moved over to the area of TOEFL, an acronym that some of you may recognize as teaching reading comprehension skills of students that don't speak English as their native language. And I think I should also point out that I am not a specialist in the Middle East. I'm not an Islamicist, but I have both personal and professional interests in the Muslims and the Middle East. I'm not sure that I even will be leading you. I thought you were the one who was supposed to lead the discussion. I just threw out a few ideas. And I particularly felt pressure when suggested by the forum topic things we should know. Maybe there's some things that we should rethink or reevaluate, though it's pretty hard to say exactly what are the things we should know in terms of the very complex subject we have before us. I'd say maybe one of the first things that we should think about is if we talk about the Middle East and we say a word like Gaddafi, and we say a word like Palestine, we have two words that immediately provoke a great deal of emotional response, a great deal of mythology on the various sides that one has in relation to such things. I'd like to broaden it a little bit more and add another one of the American perceived devils, and that is the aging Ayatollah in Iran, to just have us face up to the facts or the problems of how complicated it is to analyze the political situation in the Middle East. And though I know it's a very broad thing that you all are aware of, to remind us that the regional problems in the Middle East are that. They are significant, difficult problems in the Middle East, but they're very much a part of more global problems and the difficulty. We can hardly separate the politics of the Middle East from energy requirements and perceptions about what is needed in the Western world. We can hardly separate the domestic internal politics of the Middle East from the contention between the two superpowers. And a good amount of both the domestic and international politics of various states in the Middle East, or broadly in the Islamic world, and that's just as important too, that an adequate analysis of Middle Eastern politics has to include some concern for what we very loosely would call Islamic societies throughout the world. I can't repeat things that we tried to cover in the more formal sessions, but Islamic communities of significant size exist in every continent. There are major communities, for example, in the USSR. there are significant numbers of them in China who recently have been permitted to make a pilgrimage to a Mecca by taking a route through what once had been the Silk Road of ancient travel through Pakistan. So that immediately ties up China with Pakistan, Pakistan with the problems of the Afghanis, the Afghani problems in terms of Saudi Arabia and Mecca. Before we met tonight, someone had suggested that maybe a kind of focus would be what is the Arab disposition or attitude toward these problems. And as you might suppose, as soon as you think about it, there really is no the Arab attitude or perspective. Before I try to emphasize that particular point, let me read something that Meg Greenfield wrote in Newsweek circa 1979. You all may remember what was happening in 1979. It is testimony to the almost touchingly naive arrogance of our perceptions that we automatically equate betterment, fulfillment, and liberation for these peoples, that is, the Iranians, the Palestinians, for example, with acceptance of Western modes of behavior, dress, government, and thought. It simply does not occur to us that their rejection of any of it can have a basis other than ignorance or refusal to face the imperatives of the 20th century. Thus, progress, reform, modernization are all something that the Western world has its special meanings for, and we presume that the Islamic world should automatically accept our notions. But again, if you just think a little bit, you don't have to have had any course. You don't have to even read newspapers very regularly. You know that the experience of Muslims, like people throughout the third world, throughout the non-Western world, has told them that the West is hardly perfect. That they look at the West and they say, for example, why all the psychiatrists? Why all the legal cases? Why all the lawyers? Why so much contention? Why so much divorce? Why so much juvenile delinquency? The very kinds of problems that we, to a certain degree, face up to in our social problem courses and in various church seminars devoted to studying our problems, they focus on too. And they say, is this Western progress such an unmitigated good? There are a couple other things that I'd like to have us think about as we throw out the various questions. And that is, our own social science about the third world has done us a great deal of disservice. Our own social science, whatever its values and benefits, still reverberates with the echoes of Comtean positivism and the notion that the human societies go through various stages, and that the third stage, supposedly, of science, of mathematics, overcoming that second better stage of religion and philosophy, which had overcome superstition, brings us a better, more rational world. With this kind of mindset, religion was hardly ever recognized in various societies, or when recognized, was absolutely misinterpreted. It was seen as something that was dying, something archaic, something that always prevented modernization, growth, development, progress. And I don't think that's true. It's a very incomplete understanding of religion and religious phenomenon in the various parts of the world. I don't want to take up too much time to sort of run through all those Arab states around the Middle East or around Palestine, but just take a few. If you say, what's the perception of Saudi Arabians to Middle Eastern problems? And you say, well, you know, what kind of place is Saudi Arabia? Well, it's a society based on tribes, but one tribe, one family controls the show in a feudalistic way. It's not feudalistic absolutely. It's been very progressive in a limited sense in terms of progress. Building, industrialization, exploiting the oil. But in other ways, it's quite feudal and it's quite familial. It's our family is going to run the show. Well, there are some citizens of Saudi Arabia that say that family's not doing such a good job. They're not doing such a good job in terms of keeping out corruption. Oh, that family's got another responsibility. They're the ones that are supposed to protect the holy places. And they're not doing a good job of that. They've fallen away from their own tradition of Wahhabism, of a kind of reformism in Islam. It took them a long time, for example, that is the government of Saudi Arabia, to overcome the insurgents that took over the holy places. There was support, not obviously, we know that there was support for this rebellion in the holy places among citizens of Saudi Arabia. It just wasn't Iranians and others who had come in there. If we move up to Egypt, what do we have? Well, we have the situation of a government under President Mubarak who recognizes, I think he's trying to be realistic, that there's no way that Israel is going to be pushed to the sea. And that the best course for Egypt is a course of a peace, a course in which it tries to satisfy the needs of its own citizens. For example, the present discussions over a little enclave, a less than 1 mile square bit of territory, which the Israelis and the Egyptians are pretty well on the way to having some solution to that. And we could just go through every one of the countries that are Arabic in terms of language and culture and see significant diversity among those countries. And then if you look carefully at each one of those countries, there's a lot of difference inside the country. I'd just like to say now a little bit in detail about Libya, and a little bit in detail about Iran, though Iran is not an Arabic society. By language and culture, it is Iranian, Persian, Farsi, and in terms of its form of Islam, we tend to see it as a Shia rather than a Sunni society, as would be the case for Libya. If we were using some political science textbook that was trying to be objective, how could we characterize Libya? From a governmental point of view, we'd have to say it's kind of socialistic. It's kind of collectivistic. From a governmental point of view, we'd have to say it's a strongman. It's a dictator. From a sociological, cultural point of view, we'd have to say it's very Islamic. But this strongman has become very important. The military officer from a relatively poor background, we might even say country bumpkin, see, let's use a useful term here, I don't think that's pejorative, that describes him. Country bumpkin has a chance to go to Benghazi, studies history, goes to military school, becomes part of a revolutionary group, eventually comes to control the revolutionary group, becomes the leader of the country. But as you might expect from a country bumpkin, he has a form of Islam that he believes very strongly in. And so from his point of view, he has a special approach to Islam. He has a special approach to understanding the place of Libya in world politics. And he eventually writes his little green book, or something like Mao. His various sayings are collected in the little green book, as some of Mao's sayings were collected in the red book. From the point of view of Orthodox Islam, he's a heretic. He's more than heterodox. He's more than heterodox. Let me just give you a little bit of the idea of how he sort of reasons, and you can see how both orthodoxy and heterodoxy is sort of mixed in. And this is very important in trying to see how Gaddafi looks at the world outside of Libya. I'd also want to point out that he was a longtime admirer of Nasser, who was hardly a very realistic ruler in Egypt, but who was very popular, or at least seemed to be very popular, among the masses. From Gaddafi's point of view, Islam is to be seen as a third way. Some of you know about the third way. Sweden was supposed to be a third way, too. Various societies at various times are the third way between two supposed extremes. In his various writings, he argues something like this. Human society began to advance in the East, you know, historically. I'm not saying it's true, but just hear what he's trying to say. It originates in the East. Then it gets its advancement, all of human society gets its advancement in a certain sense as it moves west. But it got to a certain point. Now the Libyans have to look at the reality of the world. What do they have? What's their most basic resource? Their most basic resource is not oil. Their most basic resource is the Quran. What is the Quran, the holy book of the Muslim? It is the perfect book. It contains nothing that is false. I'm either quoting or paraphrasing what he has to say. Now, so far, he's pretty orthodox. There's nothing wrong in the Quran. It comes directly from God. God has created rules for the natural universe and for all his creatures in this world. The solutions for human problems, personally and internationally, are to be found in the Quran. Then he goes on, not necessarily in this order, to another one of the themes. The East. Now the East for him means USSR. The USSR and the West both intend to corrupt the Muslim. They tend to corrupt the Muslim in his soul, in his psyche, because they want not just to attack Islam as a religion, but they attack the cultures, the mores associated with Islam. They want to snuff out the Libyan personality. So then he says, we have to go back to the early period of Islam. We can't permit the West to cause us to return to the pre-Islamic paganism of the Arabs. Most of us don't recognize how important that is to the Muslim himself, to understand how, as Arabs, Muhammad left them from a very degraded state and raised them with the religion of Islam to a higher state of culture. So often what he's been saying is reconsider, re-examine. We have no need for capitalism. We have no need for communism. We have the third way in our Quran. The other devil that we presently have, though he seems to be getting a little bit less attention, of course, is Ayatollah Khomeini. I'd like to quote something that he said in 1964. This is one of the more temperate expressions of the Ayatollah. But it tells us a lot. America is worse than Britain. Britain is worse than America. The Soviet Union is worse than both of them. They are all worse and more unclean than each other. But today, America, that's what we're concerned with. Because America, for him, expressed most concretely at a given time what the Iranians, not just the Ayatollah, but many Iranians had felt. That European imperialism was destroying them in every possible dimension. Not just exploiting them for whatever resources they were there, but destroying their society through their form of modernization and westernization. Now to try to hook this up with Israel. From the point of view of many Muslims throughout the world, and very particularly from the point of view and the concern of Arab Muslims, Israel is two basic things. Israel is the intrusion in their land of a European settler community, because the Jews that came were not Middle Eastern Jews. They were primarily the Jews that initially came, the ones that started Israel as a state, something more than a homeland, had come from Europe. The second objection to Israel, and I can't overstress this really, is that they feel that Israel is Europe's way of trying to amend for European sins against the Jew. That is, the Arab must pay the price for the sins of the Christian. If you forget that, if that slips out of your mind, if that's not a part of your subconscious, you will never understand, I would argue, you will never understand the dynamics of the politics of the Middle East, nor will you ever understand why it is that some Muslims take the positions they take regarding the United States and the Europeans. So I've used up a good amount of our time, but I hope that's something that is worth hearing.
You mentioned two arch enemies of Islam, the West and the East. How come there has, I'm not aware of any concrete reaction of the Islamic world against the East. Why is it all directed? If there's an equal arch enemy, why is the Soviet Union involved in more of an Islamic reaction?
Well, there's a useful article that tries to consider the question that you asked by David Pipes in the latest issue of Foreign Affairs. And if I would rely on him, what he's saying is America really stands, most of all, concretely today, for their problems. Russia as a system isn't doing much to help Israel. We might be talking now about some efforts on the part of Russians and Israelis to discuss some outstanding problems. But Israel as a thorn in the Middle Eastern side, as a festering sore in the Arab body, is because, from their point of view, it's the United States which causes Israel to be able to exercise the power that it exercises. And I would argue, objectively, that is very much the case. Who gets the greatest amount of aid in the world today? Israel is number one. Egypt is number two in terms of military assistance. Can you guess who the third one is? I mean, this may flip you a little bit.
Is it
El
Salvador?
Huh?
El Salvador?
No, Turkey.
from the United States.
From the United States, yes. Now, Turkey, too, from one point of view, is an Islamic society, although the government since the 1920s has been a secular and militantly secular one. So maybe that's not too pertinent at this point. Turkey, although it has its ramifications. So, to go back to the original theme, it doesn't mean that the Russians are loved, but the perception, particularly among the Iranians and others, is let's take the Americans and what they claim for themselves. They claim to be the leaders of the West. Okay, they're the leaders of the West. Then they should take the brunt. It's the West that historically has been most important in attempting to control the Islamic world. It's true that the czars try to conquer Islamic peoples and had some success, and that the communist regime now has taken those Muslims over. And they, by the way, are a very large proportion of the Russian army, but they're hardly at all used in Afghanistan. You can sort of figure out the tactics involved there. So I'm not trying to justify the position of any Muslim, but I think it's not too hard to understand, given the basic premises that I pointed to, why the United States gets the largest amount of vocal criticism. There are other reasons. If the Russians provide arms to Syria, then the Syrians aren't going to immediately complain about the Russians. But again, all these things get extremely complicated. Before I came, the newspapers were talking more fully about things which had been alluded to for a long time. That is that the Israelis provide arms to the Iranians. And that the Americans have provided, either wittingly or unwittingly, plans and material of very sophisticated and secret weapons to the Israelis. One would say, well, gee, when the hostages were taken and we saw those Iranians, man, it wasn't just the United States that they were yapping about, it was Israel. And that along with the devils in the world, it's Israel. But let me emphasize, it's Israel, I would argue, not as Jews. The Muslims at least like to convince themselves that they have been more tolerant toward Jews than the Christians. And there's a good amount of historical evidence for that. Now, people like Joan Peters today and certain apologists for Israel don't want to admit that, because their present position is it's much easier to demonize all Muslims, particularly the Arabs, than to face up to the facts of a complicated history of humankind. Well, I don't want to get stuck on that particular issue or question.
How did these nations line up during World War II? Describe the Middle East in World War II.
Well, in World War II, in a sense, they weren't yet nations. In World War II, Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco were colonial parts of the French Empire. Egypt was really controlled by the British. Palestine was controlled by the British. Now again, just before going on to the other ones, sure, there was a Mufti of Jerusalem who said positive things about the Nazis. So we're everlastingly hearing about the anti-Semitism and the pro-Nazi sentiments, not only of the Mufti of Jerusalem or of Muslims. That makes no more sense to me in terms of analyzing the situation than saying that because some Indians who had been part of the British Indian Army, when captured by the Japanese, decided to fight with the Japanese against the British imperialists. Every contentious problem has people trying to figure out how we can solve our problem. Put it in another parallel category. During the Second World War, though some people were leery and some people cautioned against it, one of our great allies was the USSR. The pressure of politics will make strange bedfellows, and it will cause you rhetorically to say a lot of things which maybe a few minutes later or a few days later you would have wished you had been more temperate about. Now, the question is really quite important, because it reinforces the basic notion that we haven't been free very long. It's the West that controlled us. You notice I haven't mentioned Russia yet. Spain controlled some part of North Africa. Italy is the monster historically for the Libyans. Before the First World War, Italy attacked Libya as part of its irredentism, as part of its idea that it had to get back its old Roman Empire. That even comes before the effort to get Ethiopia back. France controls Lebanon and part of Syria. Now, how did all this come about? Because, oversimplify, the First World War killed off the sick man of Europe. That is the Ottoman Empire. Before that, these places that I've talked about had either been part of the Ottoman Empire or semi-parts of the Ottoman Empire. So it's only with World War II, subsequent to World War II, that these Middle Eastern states get nationhood. And the nationhood that they have is a nationhood, I should say statehood, let me use that word. The statehood they have is very much a consequence of what the Europeans had done to organize the area in terms of their interests, and it doesn't correspond that much to the ethnic or historical divisions. Why is Syria so interested in what's going on in Lebanon and in Palestine? Because from a certain historical point of view, Jordan and Palestine and what's today Syria are always once Syria. So it's not too surprising that they feel they have some special interest there. Why is it that some of the people don't like King Hussein? Is it because he's, you know, short? They don't like his mustache? Or they don't like the idea that he married, you know, outside of the Islamic fold? Huh? No, because he's a Hashemite. That's another group, you know. That's not our group. Again, even though we're ecumenical here, even tonight I heard somebody say, well, I was, you know, being from a Roman Catholic tradition, I couldn't tell whether she said rosaries or roses, but she was suggesting, you know, that you're not always so comfortable. You know, people don't exactly know. It's not that they don't like you all the time. He said, I'm not quite sure what to do with you because you're different. Yes?
How does Gaddafi rationalize terrorism, and what rational process does he go through to justify it? What does he hope is going to be finally accomplished by this, and how does he see himself in Libya in the future as far as their place in the world?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm the person who would try to explicate, I hate to use that word, but say how Gaddafi tries to rationalize terrorism. I wouldn't want to try to do that any more than try to rationalize terroristic activity by any government. There's a very useful article in our library here in September Harper's Magazine by Hitchens, reviewing a number of books that address themselves to terrorism. And in fact, I took a little note, and I think it's sort of propedeutic, is that a good word in this theological group? To kind of answer your question, terrorism is a convenience word, a junk word. I'm not trying to, you know, argue against you, because I use it loosely too, but he says terrorism is a convenience word, a junk word, designed to obliterate distinctions. It must be this that recommends it so much to governments with something to hide. To the practitioners of a kind of a journalism, so, you know, recognizing that, I look a little bit Hobbesian on this point. Governments use coercive force. People very often, not always, but people very often who believe they have a righteous cause, and that those that don't accept the cause, either being benighted or intransigent, need a whop. So that's the way it's done. I know that doesn't respond to the very common question. Terrorism is often against the innocent or the person who just accidentally there. I think that this is a possibility, that Gaddafi is, in this respect, a little bit like the flyers over Vietnam, who more so now that the war is over than when the war was going on, said, I know that I was an instrument, but I'm sort of like the technologist. I couldn't really see what was going on. It was in a good cause. And sometimes people, you know, we bombed the wrong village, or people got burned, but that's just the way war is. So I don't think that we really get very far by pushing this question, because it hides the more important questions. Why does he feel that terrorists should be supported? That's the other part of your question. What ultimately does he want? Ultimately, I think he does want some kind of Islamicized world. I really don't think that he's jihadi in the sense that he feels that he has to get it by sending Muslim troops and the people who are willing to die in battle for Islam in order to have a good time in heaven with the dancing girls. I mean, that's more our imagination than the Muslims' conception. in this case, he sees Israel and the West, as I indicated, as corruptors of Islamic society. That if Israel was a society which made it possible for Muslims to be first-class citizens rather than second or third-class citizens, he might not be so extreme. I don't think it's good either to try to characterize him or talk about him in psychiatric terms, whether it's a journalistic psychiatry as flaky or a madman or insane. I think these psychiatric terms are not very good as descriptive terms. They may be, in the long run, useful analytical terms. I think it's even very wrong to talk about Hitler as being madman or Stalin being madman. Because you talk about these people being madman, then you find it almost impossible to put yourself in their place. You think that there's too much the other, you know, and you don't see their common humanity. So I think if you try to dismiss them as being mad, then it's a little bit like a tough situation in the psychiatric ward. We don't have the resources to really handle you the way we'd like to, so either we restrain you or we sedate you, or maybe we have to kick you out in the street and fend for yourself. It's a difficult question, and I don't really have any good answer for it, just the response to it. Yes?
I'm interested in something about Israel, and I'm not sure that I have evidence for this, but I have a feeling that I've had some hints that there's a real connection between Israel and South Africa. And I hear about that sometimes in terms of the sale of weapons. Mm-hmm. But I'm interested from a theological perspective. If, in fact, the Jews see themselves as the chosen people, and the Afrikaner see themselves as the people of the covenant, the chosen mm-hmm. there, if there isn't a real affinity there, but a real contradiction in terms of what is being done to the blacks after the Jews have experienced the Holocaust. Am I sensing something that's real there?
Well, you're sensing a lot of things, I think, that are real, and things which, while being real, are somewhat ineffable. my current understanding of Israel as a political reality is one which emphasizes that historically Zionism asked for a homeland for the Jews. This in great measure comes about because of dissatisfaction with the societies in Europe that Jews had to live in, particularly after the Enlightenment, Napoleonic codes, and nationalist movements, and common Jewish expectation that they could be simultaneously a Jewish community and part of the national community. That's sort of one of the promises of a modern national state, that if you speak the same language, if you give allegiance to the same territory, there can be some religious difference and some kinds of cultural differences. If it was possible for Protestants and Catholics, however difficult, to make it in Germany eventually, and the aspirations that they were going to do it in various places, many Jews expected this, but it never happened. So there was the idea that we can go back to, quote, the homeland. That's original Zionism. But as Zionism develops in practice, it asks for and it gets what today we would call a national state, a nation state. So among those people who identify themselves as citizens of Israel, there are some who are Zionists and some who are not. And those who classify themselves as Zionists have various ways of classifying themselves, as religious, as political, as cultural, anti-Zionist, Zionist. I think that many of the Israelis who came and those who have grown up in later generations have unconsciously and unwittingly been racialist. Not so much or exclusively in terms of being Jews, but as being representatives of a higher culture from Europe. Because that's even expressed against their fellow Jews, the Middle Eastern Jews. They very often felt themselves to be superior. And Jewish communities in an earlier period and still today in Israel recognized that and resented them. Some of the strongest opposition to the changing of a homeland to a national state come from Jewish communities already resident in Israel, or in Palestine before it becomes Israel. But as the conflict between the Arabs and the state of Israel, the Jews there, continues, and the dangers to the life of the Jews continue, then you get a special push to some elements of Zionism, which are more millenarist, which are more exclusivist, and which say, not only that we have this national homeland, but there is Eretz Israel, and God knows, really I mean that, only God, Yahweh, knows what those boundaries are. So there is a kind of imperialism for some Jews and Zionists. I don't think it's inherent in Judaism any more than, let's say less, it's less inherent in Judaism than it is in certain interpretations of Islam. I'm less prepared to say anything about the theological underpinnings of the South Africans, but they too, I think, see themselves as beleaguered cultural, religious remnant. They had to overcome the British. They never forget that. They've never forgotten that, no matter what degree English and English language are a part of that system. They see themselves as a standing against a kind of imperialism. Like the Israelis, they kid themselves or they mythologize their past in terms of turning a wasteland into something that is productive. That's a terrible mythology that most of us have accepted about Israel. But there's a form of that in South Africa. And as Christians, in some ways you have to justify your economic position, your more exalted position. I really don't want to try to say more about the theological thing on the practical political level. There certainly is the shipment of arms and technical personnel to South Africa. But my personal position is that sometimes the sort of ideological parallels, though interesting, are pushed too far as explanations for what goes on. In some ways, I'm even more cynical about the Israeli position, that Israel needs money, it needs friends, and it will sell weapons, give technical assistance to anybody that they can eventually have as a friend, particularly in terms of votes in the UN, or to make money. That partly explains what's going on with Iran, but it's not the complete answer. Israel fears Iraq more than it fears Iran. Though if you look at the map, Iraq looks smaller, but there's a certain kind of a technological capacity that they have worried about in the past that bothers them more.
Just to follow up quick, Ben, the disturbing thing for me is that we may say that we won't sell arms to South Africa, but we will just go out of our way to do anything you can imagine for Israel, and that stuff gets into other people's hands. And our leaders must know that. I mean, it's pretty clearly known. How can we continue to do that?
Well, again, the issue of rational behavior comes up, and Stockman's comments about the government not knowing what it does with money should be applied to the government not knowing what its various hands are doing. Two hands are insufficient to talk about large complex governments. It's more like Shiva or some centipede, you know. Partly because of the vested interests in various sections of the government, and partly because of lack of communication. In terms of congressional politics, in terms of presidential politics, our domestic voting patterns have a lot to do with what our policy toward Israel. One can oversimplify the idea of the Jewish lobby, but very clearly there is a Jewish lobby that's quite effective and quite successful. And what it might lack in reality, in some respects, is conjured up in the imaginations of politicians, so play it safe. It's a little bit like Ambrosian or who wrote Ponce, I can't think of it now, you know, wagering on the existence of God, that even if there isn't all these Jewish votes, it's better to be safe that they're there and do what I think they're going to do than to displease them.
Doesn't Israel act as a kind of surrogate in terms of military weapons and personnel in other areas of American interest, like Central America as well?
Oh, yeah. When you start looking at the arms sale, Israel is important in terms of getting weapons to various groups in Central America. But that's a whole nother can of worms that no government adequately controls, because there are people who once have worked for those governments, CIA, military people, who know how to get those weapons, and they don't give a damn. They really don't give a damn about what, or the patriotic or the national interests of their country. They're just out after the bucks. In some cases, they're sort of adventurers. I mean, it isn't even making bucks. It's the thrill of being involved in these kinds of things. They're sort of contemporary buccaneers that instead of moving from one country to another country and pirating for them, they sell to whoever wants to sell. The world is much less rational in terms of politics than we'd like to think. Yes,
Kate? I guess the thing that makes me uncomfortable is that I guess I started noticing it maybe in the mid-70s, but that people will have a conversation about the Middle East and explain that they're not anti-Semitic, they're just anti-Zionist.
Mm-hmm.
And as the conversation goes on, sometimes it gets into a very weird place and you start hearing about the world Jewish banking conspiracy,
mm-hmm.
or about how the Jews are out to make money doing this or that. And that's when I get very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It seems that people are always in a position of either we love Israel or we hate them, or the Jew is still the other. The Jew seems to still be that object which we project the things that we dislike,
mm-hmm.
about ourselves onto. And I'm just wondering if there's a way to view the Middle East in terms of its future that would include, here's the question, is do the Arabs, can the Arabs envision a Middle East with Israel, or should we take their rhetoric seriously that they will drive Israel into the sea? And if that is true, where does that put our anti-Zionist rhetoric?
Well, let me try to answer an earlier part of the question and an earlier part of your important description of what is the experience of many of us. There is no Arab disposition regarding the long-term existence of Israel. I would say that King Hussein, the ruler of Jordan, accepts it, that Israel is there. Whether Israel's boundaries have to be exactly what they are today is a different question. The PLO, as an umbrella organization for Palestinians, has several times publicly retracted or recanted the idea that we will drive Israel into the sea. Many spokesmen, but not all, many spokesmen who claim to speak for Jewish interests throughout the world, or for Zionist, or for Israeli national interests, say that's really not true, that it's just a form of deception. And then they say, well, in order to prove that the PLO, or Palestinian militants, don't want to drive Israel into the sea, why don't they recognize the state of Israel? Now, at first, that seems like a very good question. The reason, in part, why it seems such a good question is because most of us have been pretty well socialized to accept that Israel is a legitimate state. We never had the experience of the fundamental Palestinian or Arab notion that it is an illegitimate state. Two, if the Palestinians recognize Israel as a state, de jure, and not just de facto, I mean, they got to recognize that it's there. Otherwise, what would they be fighting against? We should say to ourselves, hey, how come you don't recognize either the PLO or something as being a Palestinian state? Well, they say, well, but where is the Palestinian state? Ah, good question. Where is the Palestinian state? So the Palestinian, the Arab, I think legitimately can reply, well, that's a damn good question. We're not going to recognize you until you make sufficient effort to somehow give us an existence which is other than, quote, terrorist, other than refugee. That seems to me to be a reasonable position. So in terms of one part of the question, there is no clear single Arab attitude toward the state of Israel. More and more Palestinians, some people say, are more and more accepting the idea that we're not going to be able to get rid of Israel. So then there are all kinds of possibilities of dual states, of partition states, weighted voting. It goes back, makes me think of all the theories about proportional representation. I'm not trying to say that we shouldn't revive some of those. So that's a possibility. I think it's also important to move into the second part of your question about are people sincere, or what do they mean when they say, I'm not anti-Semitic, I'm anti-Zionist, or I want to criticize the state of Israel. And that is that there are Israeli citizens who complain about the nature, the fundamental nature of Israeli government and society, that they don't want it to be, for want of a better term, a theocracy. They don't want it to be a police state which claims to be the only democracy in the Middle East. Again, that's mythology. It's a democracy in some very important senses, but it's not a democratic society in terms of the total number of people who make up the sociological community. There is torture in Israel. There is collective retribution. That's recognized by some Israelis as something to complain about. It's recognized by many Israelis, but not something to complain about. Again, it's sort of like dropping the atom bomb. You know, that's just part of the way it is to protect ourselves. But there are Israeli equivalents to, say, American Civil Liberties Union. There is the Communist Party. I know it sounds bad to us, but again, you know, forget about your prejudices. The Communist Party in Israel is one of the most consistent critics of terrorists and the torture and harassment of Muslims in the state of Israel. Now, your concrete example of the person who starts out by saying, making the important distinction, not anti-Semitic, but anti-Zionist, but then gets to the point of talking about the worldwide Jewish conspiracy. If they get to that point, then the legitimacy of the first part, I begin to doubt. I think in those particular cases, yeah, you are something, or maybe very much, of an irrational anti-Semite or anti-Jew. But what it comes down to then, there are form A and form B of people who say, I'm not anti-Semitic, but I am anti-Israel. And it does not, form A does include Jews themselves. There are various groups in the United States, Jewish groups in the United States, who are anti-Israel in a very comprehensive sense, that they don't think it should exist, or anti-Israel in the sense of criticizing particular policies. They also exist in Israel as a state. A similar thing, I've already put myself in danger of being accused of being anti-Semitic because I alluded to the Israeli Zionist lobby in the United States. No political scientist, it seems to me, could deny that there's a Jewish lobby in the United States any more than a political scientist could say there is no Lutheran lobby in various ways in the United States. The existence of the things has to be admitted. The more difficult thing is to try to describe adequately and understand what it is that they want and whether you agree with what they want and what do you think about the means they have for getting what they want.
Yeah. I think one of the things that most Americans don't understand, it took me a long time to understand, is what it means to have a Jewish state. What it means to have a Jewish state is that only Jews are full citizens. So it would be equivalent to having America be a Christian state. Or let's say a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Christian state, which means everybody who don't have that identity would be very clearly second-class citizens. But even more than that, the group who claim that dominant identity would have a very strong stake in keeping anybody who weren't quite Anglo-Saxon Protestants as a very small minority, so they wouldn't challenge the dominance of the dominant identity. And that's exactly the dilemma that the Zionist Jewish state concept has created in Israel. And what does it mean is that those Palestinians or non-Jews who are certain areas of the 1948-49 Israel they have certain kind of citizenship, and yet they certainly are partly the hostage people. But certainly the West Bank is under sort of permanent military rule because Israel cannot incorporate that group of people into citizenship without losing a Jewish majority. So if you define a state as a Jewish state, you have, it's one of the few states in the world in which citizenship is linked with ethno-religious identity. And so what many Palestinians and Arabs would say, yeah, we can coexist with something called Israel, but it has to reorganize its governmental and citizenship rules. That's what we have to be clear about. What kind of rules of citizenship pertain to, because you really have a dual citizen. You have democracy for Jews, and you have essentially a kind of apartheid. That's not the analogy of white South Africa, by the way. A kind of very repressive, not a repressive military rule, but a kind, I think, there's a good deal of evidence, but a kind of policy of push out of non-Jews in order to maintain a dominant majority of Jews, because the threat is that the state would cease to be a Jewish state at the point when Jews were no longer the overwhelming majority. So I think that's the dilemma. And it's very peculiar because the Jewish community who are liberals in the United States would never, of course, accept a Christian state here. And yet they, in effect, have bought in for a lot of very complicated reasons to that kind of definition of citizenship for the state of Israel.
Has our government accepted that the Palestinian people are going to have a homeland someday? What is our government's position on this?
I see no evidence that the government, that the present administration, by the present administration, I'm thinking of the president, his advisors, and the most significant people he's put into the State Department, have that view. There have been a few indications of this in the past. I can't give you the exact dates and stuff, where they have moved in that direction of saying that the basic problem is roughly a homeland for the Palestinians. But they've immediately pulled back on the issue of the PLO. And that just seems to me to be unrealistic in terms of Palestinians as a total group. In the long run, it may mean that the PLO will be less and less an instrument of Arafat. It certainly is, that's, he has less and less control over PLO today as a military force. The more extreme people broke off for him at the time of the Lebanon crisis, they're now resident in Syria and in other places. King Hussein last month kicked out the PLO from Jordan. He's broken off the talks with the Arafat. And it's hard for me to know exactly what's all in his mind. There certainly are those people who say he'd like some understanding with Israel so he can get the occupied territories for Jordan. Then those Palestinians would be part of a Jordanian state. Now, of course, there's some Palestinians that are willing to accept that, but I think particularly overseas Palestinians, who in a sense have a certain freedom that Palestinians in the Middle East don't have, they're not going to support that. But I think the present administration is fairly blind in a number of ways. I don't know how much, I just wouldn't want to say it's a malice, that their perception or understanding of the history of the Middle East is a significantly defective, and their ability to examine history is reduced by the concern with contemporary politics, that is domestic politics, with certain kinds of friendships. And so I'm not optimistic at all in that respect.
Well, we're past 10, but remember, people are coming in for compliment, but obviously this has caught people. So.